Hi everybody, this is Armand Deville. With you, with the positive mind. Some new engineering challenges today. Ken, we're still working on it. Be right back with you. Today about relationships, and we have with us Dr. Terry Orbach. Terry, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hey, thank you. Hi.
That's good. We got that piece of the engineering working. Terry, I was fascinated. I saw your book. I looked at the title and I said, "Oh no, how simple." Because I would imagine that somebody could come along and say something like five simple steps to take your marriage from good to great. And I said, boy, that's the kind of book they would sell in Detroit. Not certainly in New York. But as I went through it, I was fascinated by the research. So I think you have something really worthwhile today for the audience. Let's start with the basis of your research.
Right. Thanks, Armand, for having me, too. I think what's really unique, as you mentioned, about this book is that it's based on scientific evidence. It's not my personal experiences, nor even the experiences of my clients as a marriage and family therapist, but it's based on a study that started in 1986. It's funded by the National Institutes of Health, and it continues to be funded by the National Institutes of Health. I've been following the same 373 couples now for over 25 years, and I've been interested in what keeps people together, the factors that keep people together and happy, and what are the factors that break people up. All of the couples were married in 1986, and over time, Armand, about 46% of them have divorced, which is about the national average of 45%.
Even though they knew you were watching.
Yes, even
you
though
know,
they
even
knew.
You figured they would, if you would at least get that effect of knowing that you're part of a research, you would do better. What was that? The Hawthorne effect, I think it's called. Yes. And the Hawthorne effect, just because you're part of a study, you automatically improve your functioning. And you're saying, no, these couples, 1986, National Institutes of Health, studied them, and we find the same averages. So we have something to really learn from this.
We really do have something to learn from it. We also looked at the characteristics of the people getting married in 1986, and I compared those qualities to people who were getting married in the census data and another national study, and they're very comparable in terms of education and income. Those people who lived together before they got married, those people who had children before they got married. So we're really talking about a generalized sample that whatever we find is comparable across the United States.
Okay, one of the things we could say is that it is prescribed as marriage, but where is the location? Where were these people located? Were they rural? Were they middle America? Where were these? How many couples from where? What areas?
Well, all 373 couples lived in a county in the Midwest, and I can't disclose the county, but there were some that were rural, some that were urban or living in a rural or urban community. They all applied for marriage licenses in 1986 during a four-month period of time.
Okay, and so let's see what we can learn about Midwestern marriages, because even though that may be a little different, maybe there's a lot to learn. Like, one of the things that fascinate me is that there are certain things that we believe we know for sure about marriages, like things like opposites attract and things like that. And you found that there were a number of myths about marriage that this study kind of dispelled. Can you talk about those?
Yes, absolutely, Armand. There are a number of myths that the couples had in the study, as well as I think we all have about relationships and love and the opposite sex. And what I found is that frustration, which is the difference between what you expect to happen in a relationship and what actually does, is one of the leading reasons people become unhappy in a relationship. So the bigger the difference between what you expect and the reality, the more frustration and the more unhappiness. And there are specifically 10 of those myths that I talk about in my book. Number one, as you mentioned, it is that opposites attract. And what we found in this study is exactly the opposite, that similarity in underlying values and attitudes is really what keeps people together over the long haul and what keeps people happy in those marriages.
Well,
or relationships.
Similarities, you said, in viewpoints.
Yes.
So when I talk about opposites attract, I mean more like personality styles. Like, for example, I find that somebody who is manic is very often attracted to somebody who's depressed because they have so much energy that they find somebody with low energy and it kind of balances itself out. You're not talking about that. You're talking about value systems.
I'm talking about values and attitudes, lifestyle issues about money or children or religion and the importance of those things in your life. So not personality qualities.
So when people say opposites attract, I'm sure they're not saying somebody who loves religion falls in love with somebody who hates religion. Those are opposites, but I don't think anybody refers to that. I think the opposites that we usually talk about are personality opposites. But you're saying that's so, it's not that that's not true, but the place where opposites do not attract is if there's an opposite value system. If I believe that we should support the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and you believe that we shouldn't, we're not going to make a very good couple.
Absolutely, because we're going to have a lot of disagreements. We're going to have a lot of conflict over the relationship, over the term of the relationship. So those values, those big attitudes, as you just mentioned, Armand, are what you want to be similar on. And if you think that you should be different on those underlying attitudes or values, you're going to become frustrated over the course of the relationship, which then is going to eat away at the happiness in the relationship.
Okay, that's so the myth isn't debunked. The myth is kind of redefined.
Yeah. Right. I think that's true, Armand, that one could say that the myth is redefined. And we could take another myth and see if that's also the case.
I want to make mention that we said basically for male-female couples, but a lot of this holds true for same-sex couples as well.
Correct. I think these steps, these five simple steps that I talk about and the findings from my study are true for all romantic relationships, whether they be opposite sex or same-sex relationships, as well as non-marital relationships
right.
in general. So these are true for all romantic relationships at all stages of the relationship as well.
Thank you. So continue. You said the second myth.
Well, I think another interesting myth is that a perfect marriage is one with no conflict. One of the things that we found in this study is that many of the couples believed that showing conflict, having disagreements with your spouse was negative, that meant that their relationship was in trouble. And it was exactly the opposite. In fact, those couples that reported that they had no conflict were actually the couples that were no longer together 2 years down the road or 4 years down the road. So the myth is that a perfect marriage is one with no conflict. The relationship reality is that all couples have some amount of conflict, and it turns out how you deal or manage with that conflict turns out to be more important to the stability or the happiness in that relationship.
So a relationship that's never tested because there is no conflict and everything is smooth and it's kind of easy and bland and Connecticut-like, that's not one necessarily. I mean, you may have a perfect meeting of values and you may have a perfect meeting of personalities, and you may have two people who are so sane they just don't get into conflict. But in general, with couples, when people have conflict and get past conflict, they seem to have better relationships.
Exactly, Armand, because they're also talking about the things that are important to each other. As you mentioned, if you're not having any disagreements or conflict, you're probably not sharing or revealing you in the relationship. Because when you think about it, we all come from different families. We all come from different neighborhoods. If we're talking about a heterosexual relationship, we have two people who are looking at the relationship completely different. And so you're bound to disagree or have arguments about things that are happening in the relationship and things that are happening in your life.
This is Armand DeMille with Stephanie Dombra today. We are talking to Dr. Terry Auerbach. Terry Auerbach wrote a book titled Five Simple Steps to Take Your Marriage from Good to Great. I take that, and from that, I've noticed there are a number of things in here that are worthwhile hints that people can use in their relationships. Right now, we're talking about some of the myths that people have, and I think the myths that people have sometimes are confused as to what they say, like you should never have conflict. Well, if you're hitting each other early on in the relationship with, you know, a bat, you know, if one of you has a club and the other one has a taser and you're using it on each other all the time and it's not sex play, then it's a real question. It's a real question. It's a real question as to whether that relationship's going to work. If you're hurting each other, if you're doing things to each other, if you're verbally abusing each other, that's one thing. But taking that down a level and saying just conflict, there are things that I like that you don't like, there are things that I disagree with about you, and I want to talk to you about it, that seems to lead, according to Terry, to a better relationship because you're kind of revealing yourself somewhat. Terry, continue. What other myths are there that we deal with?
I think that there are many myths. One of the other myths that is important is that to be happy, you need to talk about challenges and problems often. I think many of us grow up thinking that the more we talk about challenges and our problems, the better. But I think that is a myth. What I found from the couples in my study is that women love to talk about issues and problems. In fact, women love to do what I call relationship talk. They like to talk about the relationship and things going on in the relationship, regardless if it's negative or positive. On the other hand, and by the way, Armand, that leads to happiness, and it's very rewarding when women do that. But on the other hand, the husbands or the men in my study found relationship talk not so beneficial. And in fact, the more they did it, the less happy they were in the relationship, and the more likely that relationship was to end in divorce over time.
Well, there's some major studies have appeared recently about the role of serotonin, I think, Stephanie, right? It was serotonin in, and how women, when they speak, relationships speak, there's a higher, an increase in serotonin. Is that right?
Yeah, that's been around for a number of years now. We understand that women really do like to talk. Not that men don't. These are not extreme generalizations, but most times women really do get their serotonin replaced when they talk.
So the very process of talking,
yes,
regenerates serotonin, which for women gets lost easily because
throughout
of the,
day.
Because of the
yes.
cycle and throughout a day. Men who don't have their serotonin depleted at that level, they find that the talking, what does it do? It's like, it must work almost the opposite for them. Because men get annoyed by that much discussion.
Right. Exactly. And what I also found, Armand, is that the men, when they do so much relationship talk, they do tend to think that the relationship is in trouble, and they blame themselves for that trouble, regardless of what wife or woman says and what she's talking about in terms of the relationship. So one of the things that the couples in my study who were happy and still together needed to do is they needed to negotiate an amount of time. And that time was not constant, frequent talk about the relationship.
Well, you see, but Terry, it's if the idea of talking is to replenish the serotonin and really has little to do with the issue at hand. I had a man who came in here the other day. He says, "You got to do something. My wife just wants to keep talking at me all the time." He said, "She's not talking to me. She's talking at me." Well, with a little investigation, we found that she had low serotonin levels, and through this talking, she was trying to replace her neurotransmitters by doing this. So now, if the idea of talking is simply to replace neurotransmitters and it doesn't have anything to do with the content, then the thing you can't do is talk about the value of the content. Because the content of these conversations, sometimes they're just like, you're just talking. And it's got value. That's why I think when women get together and talk with each other, they could talk for hours and enjoy it. They could walk away saying, "Oh boy, I really enjoyed being able to talk and be heard." But really what was happening was like a group serotonin raise. And I think that that was very important. Whereas men, when they get together, they don't talk.
Right.
They basically, you know, they're looking at a football game. And it's not because they're dumbos, but because they don't have that same chemical, physical need.
Right. And I think there's that chemical, physical need that women have that you're talking about that men don't. But there's also how we've been brought up in childhood as well. And so there is this biological component. But I also think, Armand, that there is a social component, that women grow up being reinforced with talking to their friends. They're reinforced and rewarded for that type of talk, which men are not. And so there is that biological, physiological component, as you're mentioning, but I also think that there is that social, childhood socialization perspective as well.
Well, if we look back to the beginning of mankind and when humans first got on this planet, you'll find that it was among the females that there was the most jabbering. You know, they were talking to each other almost like they were communicating things about things. It's like you're almost telling stories as well. And it may be part of the woman's role to be able to be the communicator. The trouble is it doesn't make the man wrong for not being the communicator.
See,
and that's what we do. So we bring the men into therapy so that they can talk about their emotion more. What do you think, Stephanie?
Well, I just am thinking about this image. First of all, I agree with that. All the time I hear the same kind of complaint. I want to listen to her, but I can only take maybe 15 minutes. And I understand, I'm a woman, I like to talk too, I understand these concepts. But think about those days when men were hunting. You couldn't talk, you had to be quiet. It wasn't about the talking, it was the strategizing, and they were separating to go and kill that beast. Women are gathering and talking and doing all these activities
and
together.
Helping each other gather, so, and saying, look over there and look over there, and you could find it under the tree.
Exactly.
And
language
the men are
developed.
Saying, be quiet, we got to get this.
Right. And so I think that I often tell my clients, go and talk to your friends, and you'll get more satisfaction. And then you can check in with your partner and your spouse and then go from there and not feel like you have to get this need met by him. Do things together that are joyous that he likes and you like together.
And so, you know, you don't have to create, as very many people do. They try to create something to be of interest to both people to be discussed. So, for example, let's talk about, I have to find something really important to talk about. So I, as a woman, have to find something that will engage you. Therefore, I have to create a problem. And very often, that's what a man feels. That's what a mate feels. Not only men who do this. Men do the same thing to their women as well. It's like, hey, relax. There is no problem.
But I agree. This is Terry. I agree completely with both of you that I think what's important to understand as well is that there are these differences between the sexes, and that acknowledging them and accepting them rather than trying to change our partner or create problems is really what's important. And understanding, then we become less frustrated.
So do you say sweat the small stuff or don't sweat the small stuff?
I say sweat the small stuff. One of the things that I found in my study, and one of the key findings from this project, was that small annoyances, not the large ones, like illness or job loss, are really what eroded marital happiness over time. So it wasn't the job loss or financial difficulties or the health of a parent, which many of these couples experienced over time. Actually, what I found is that when those kinds of challenges occurred, people came together, they leaned on one another, and they supported each other. But instead, it was these small, seemingly insignificant things, like he leaves his socks around, she spends too much money on household items, that start off small, but accumulate over time. And when they accumulate over time, they become these big, huge problems. And because I was able to follow the couples over time, I can actually see them becoming larger and larger and eroding the happiness and then eventually perhaps leading to divorce.
Well, okay, so let's say it's a possibility, Terry, thank you. That what happens is if a person has a gripe and the other person decides to deal with that gripe by either ignoring or stonewalling the partner, that it is the very act of ignoring or stonewalling that is the sign that the relationship's going to be in trouble. It's not the fact that they're not dealing with the issue, but the way you deal with the issue is you shut the other person off. And if you're a mate who shuts off your mate because they complain, as many mates do, if you're a woman who says, well, my husband's always worried or always complaining, so I'm not going to listen to him, if you do that over time, you create a separation that's very hard to overcome. You know, so I agree with you that I think the small stuff, not that you have to really deal with it, but you can't really ignore it.
Exactly. You can't ignore it. You need to address it. It may not go away, but you need to you can't ignore it. I completely agree, because there are all these consequences. There are the consequences of wife not bringing it up anymore. There are the consequences of if you bring it up again and again and again, stonewalling or the other partner shutting you off or out. And so you really need to address or not ignore them. You can also get extremely physically upset if you just ignore an issue and it festers inside of you, then there are physical effects on you as an individual as well.
Well, people have a great deal of difficulty talking about sexual differences or sexual problems in relationships. And usually you'll find one or another person in a relationship does not like to talk about it. They're not used to talking about it, yet the person is dying. You know, a woman or a man is looking at their, thinking to themselves, our sex relationship is dying slowly. We're down to once a month, and we barely even do that. And it's, I want to be able to talk about it, but how do I talk about it? Because he or she doesn't want to have this conversation with me. Those kind of things go underground, and they manifest in a whole bunch of behaviors that wind up being like substitutes for not being able to have the conversation. You know, I think that's part of the reason we have sex therapists around, therapists who specialize in having that, because people are so uncomfortable talking about that and other issues as well. What about fear? Do people talk about their fears?
Fears in what way, Armand?
Like, I'm afraid that we're not going to be able to meet the mortgages. I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job. Is a person's job their need to secure, keep the other person feeling secure? Or can a person show when they're scared? Do you find that more people who show their fears or discuss their fears have a longer relationship? Or is it better to just buckle up and, you know, stay strong and be strong for your mate?
I think the important thing that I found in this study was that it's important to be real with your partner. It's important that couples really feel like they understand one another, and there were four specific areas that were important, and I think fears goes in that second category, and I'll just give you all four categories. It was important that one partner understood and knew the friends that the other partner hung out with or talked to or felt close to. That was the first category. Second, it was important that one partner knew the stressors of the other partner, what kept the other partner up at night. And so I think that has to do, Armand, with fears, job insecurities, money woes, those kinds of fears of not having the money to pay for the mortgage or not feeling secure in a job and it might be lost at any time. The third area was the life dreams of the partner. And then the fourth area was the values, the what they wanted to be remembered as, what was really important and essential to the core of the other partner. And I think what happens is that at the beginning, with all these couples, they really felt they knew those four areas of their partner. We tend to do a lot of that when we first meet someone, when we first get married to that person. We know those four areas. But over time, over the next 25 years of that relationship, many people didn't continue to check in with one another and continue to know what their partner did or felt in those four areas. Those people, those partners who continue to understand and know their partners in these four areas were the happy couples and the couples that stayed together over time.
Well, great. You know, we're going to be taking a short break. And we're going to be taking a break. We'll make some announcements, and then we'll play a little music. Got some special music for you guys today. And then after that, if you would, Terry, stick with us. Because I want to continue with this, and I want to go through the five steps, as you've seen it. And I want to also continue around the myths. And what we're going to be doing with the myths. You know, more of the myths that we have to deal with. So if you would stay with us. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're talking with Dr. Terry Orbuch about the five simple steps to take your marriage from good to great. And we're going to see. Let me see now. Okay. Oops. No announcements?
No. You make the announcement.
Here we go. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with you in just a couple of seconds. life is a tango. Hopefully, every relationship is a tango. It's called the Ultimo Tango in Paris. That's the way it should feel. You know, that's the way we want it to feel in every relationship. Even if you're broken down and you can't kind of get through and you have problems that you have to deal with, being able to dance with your partner is such an important thing, however you do that dance. This is Armand DeMille with Stephanie Dombra and the Positive Mind here on WBAI. We're talking with Dr. Terry Orbuch, who wrote a book for the five simple steps to move your relationship from good to great.
I just want to make a comment about this beautiful video you sent me from the YouTube. It was the tango. The women, the man and the woman were dancing the tango with the soccer ball in Spain or
somewhere.
Oh, in
Spain.
It was right. So beautiful. People
and now,
want to
now
look
people are going
up.
To want to find it. What are they going to look up?
World Cup, maybe tango.
Tango with the soccer ball.
Beautiful.
2-1-2. Oh, no. Let's get back to Terry. Terry Orbuch. Terry, are you still there?
I am still here. I'm
good, good, good. Here. Let's go to the five steps.
You want me to just talk about
it? Go ahead. Do it.
Okay, the first one is you want to expect less and get more. As I mentioned before, frustration was one of the leading reasons why couples became unhappy over time in my long-term study on marriage. And frustration, again, is the difference between what you expect and what you get in your marriage. And what I found is that when partners have realistic expectations of their partner, they actually know the top two relationship expectations of their partner. They are happier over time. And so what I encourage people to do is sit down with their partner and each write down their top two marriage expectations, exchange lists, and discuss, because the exercise lets you know what's important to your partner. And I list the top 16 marriage expectations that the couples in my study had for their relationship. So that's all.
Could you go over the top 16?
Yes, there's quite a few. Actually, there's 16, but I can mention just a few.
Just mention them briefly.
For example, one is you should cool off before you say too much if you're fighting. Many of the partners felt that that was utterly, essentially important. Number two, many felt you should enjoy leisure time together. Number three, you should always say what is on your mind. Four, you should always settle a fight quickly. The number one relationship expectation is that you should feel that your spouse would never hurt or deceive you. And that was the number one expectation for husbands and wives.
Now, these are expectations which lead to disappointments.
Absolutely. And disappointment really is frustration.
Right. So these lead to the frustration because the truth of it is you shouldn't always say what's on your mind. Mm-hmm. Let's go back over each one, just of the ones you mentioned. That always saying what's on your mind may be a mistake. Cool down first.
Absolutely. That's so important then that couples sit down with each other. If that is my expectation and you're not able to do that as my spouse or partner, or it's just totally unrealistic of couples, as you mentioned, Armand, then we need to sit down and discuss and compromise, because I'm just going to continually get frustrated if that's my expectation.
The primary expectation nowadays is that every person should be willing to share all of their feelings and talk about what they feel readily. And if they don't, there's something repressed about them and they should go to therapy.
Well, that's not a realistic expectation
It was one of the 80s and 90s, I think.
Yes.
You know? Okay, so good. Trying to respect a person for who they are. I really like this idea of asking your partner about your two biggest expectations. Is that what they
are? Once you know what's in your partner's head and heart, then you are more likely to be able to meet that expectation, or the two of you need to discuss so you can compromise on what can happen in the relationship if it's not a realistic expectation.
Okay, good. Okay, continue.
Step two is give incentives and rewards. The number one finding that I was very surprised about in this long-term study is that affective affirmation was so essential to happiness and the stability of these marriages over time. An affective affirmation is the degree to which you feel like your partner makes you feel special, worthwhile, cared for, and loved. And if you don't feel like your partner makes you feel special and valued, those couples were almost two times more likely to get divorced over time. That finding was so significant in this study, and it was even more significant for the husbands than it was for the wives. So men crave and need affective affirmation more than the wives or the women.
Men crave to be valued?
Yes, from their wives.
From their wives.
More than wives do. It's not that wives don't crave to be valued and cared for, but it turns out the wives or women in general get that affective affirmation from a lot of other people in their lives. And these are what the wives told me.
Especially since many of them are mothers, and they get the affirmations from their children.
They get it from their children, absolutely. They get it from their best friends, female, other friends, as we were talking about. Even from the stranger, many of the wives would tell us that they get affective affirmation from strangers in the coffee shop who said, "Wow, I love your haircut," or somebody walking down the street, "Where'd you buy those shoes?" Those are all forms of affective affirmation, and wives get it from a lot of other people. Men or the husbands in this study did not get the same kind of affective affirmation from friends, from their children, or from strangers. So they really needed it from their wives.
But, you know, it's a kind of a cultural thing, too, that men are not supposed to be susceptible to compliments. You know, it's like if you say something nice to a man, it's almost like his tendency is to throw it off, is to ward it off, is to you know, kind of let it bounce off him in many ways. So there's almost a part of being grown up where you're showing that you're not affected by those things. And what you're saying is, yeah, but underneath it, that man does need this as well, especially from the person he has chosen to spend his life with. That men are more sensitive than we imagine.
Exactly. They're more sensitive, and they need that validation, that reassurance of self-worth.
And I just want to interject here. I'm going to make a slight generalization, so I apologize. But I think in the past, anyway, that's why men were more susceptible to having outside affairs, because there was attention that they were getting from a woman, because, again, women have all these relationships with others, but a man may be more susceptible to somebody flirting and giving him attention, and then it can turn into a sexual relationship.
So what you're saying, I think, is men feel themselves becoming invisible as they age. And in their invisibility, they who take their wives for granted get taken for granted as well. And without the compliment, without the recognition, without the affirmation and acknowledgement, they look for it. And if they suddenly see it coming from someone else, they become very susceptible to it. So it's like a carrot on a stick. That's what they follow. And I wonder how much of it becomes sexual just because that's a way of consummating it. But really what it's about is getting that acknowledgement and recognition.
And I would agree with both of you. That's what the men or the husbands said in this long-term study, that when they didn't get that affirmation, validation of self, they looked for it or they found it in others. And even though the men in this study said that it didn't always start sexual, it started with the recognition of being special and noticed, so that the lack of it in their marriage then created the opening or the opportunities to see it elsewhere. And what I really want to stress in this book is that it doesn't take much to give affective affirmation to one's partner or husband. The husbands in this study said that it was very simple, and it could occur through words or behaviors. So a simple "I love you" to the husbands in this long-term study was affective affirmation. A simple kiss or hug was behavior or an action that showed affective affirmation. So at least according to the husbands in this long-term study, it was not lots and lots, and it's not hard to either say or show affective affirmation.
You know, one of the things that the men who are in my groups talk about frequently, or one of the things that they've talked about, is "I'm proud of you." You know, there's some part of them that begs to hear those words, "I'm proud of you." And that means that I have pride in saying that you're my mate. I feel pride. And that's, that'll go right to the heart of most men. You know, more than a good lasagna.
I like that phrase a lot. I'm proud of you. That the men in this study said that was so important to them was when, in some form, their wives said, "I would still choose you."
Mm-hmm.
If I had to do it all over again.
"I would still choose you." Interesting. Okay, let's continue with the steps.
Step 3 is to have daily briefings. I talk a lot about getting to know your partner again. We talked a little bit about this earlier, that at the beginning of a relationship, you're constantly learning new and interesting things about your partner, but over time, we stop asking the questions. Instead, we communicate, but we maybe communicate about the children. We may be communicating about who's going to pick up the groceries or who's going to call mom or pay the bills. But the happy couples over time continue to have what I call the 10-minute rule or these daily briefings, asking questions to one another about things that are at the core of each other and really try to get to know one another again, that it's not just communicating about the household tasks and maintaining the household and the relationship, but it's questions. And I give lots of lists of questions because a lot of people say, "Well, what do we talk about? What are you most proud of? What would you do if you won the lottery? Where would you travel to if you could travel anywhere in the world?" These are discussions that a lot of couples no longer have over time.
The 10-minute rule?
Yes, the 10-minute rule. Every single day, talking about something other than work, family, who's going to do what around the house, or your relationship. So spending 10 minutes every single day talking about something other than those four topics.
Okay, let's continue. Let's continue with the steps.
The fourth step is to implement change. One of the things that couples experienced over time was what we call relationship rut, lack of passion and a lack of sexuality over time. And so when couples implement newness, anything that's new in their relationship, whether it be a new activity or class or dance class that we take together, a new bottle of wine, a new restaurant, when couples implement mystery, when there's a little bit of surprise going on in the relationship, when I don't know exactly what's going to happen day after day, less likely to be in a rut. And when I implement what I call third, arousal-producing activities, any activity that gets my adrenaline or my arousal to increase in the relationship, that can be exercise, a scary movie, or riding a roller coaster together, when couples implement those three things, newness, mystery, and arousal-producing activities, all change. The couples in my study said that got them out of the relationship rut increased passion and increased sexual desire in the relationship.
That's something we've certainly heard from other researchers as well, especially doing something different. Huh, Stephanie?
Yes, Dr. Arthur Aaron. I don't know if you know who he is, Terry.
Yes, we've actually written a paper together
using
the data from this project.
Oh, I'm going to have to look that up. Great.
So we wrote a paper looking at how couples who were in a relationship rut could get out of that rut and be more happy or increase happiness over time.
All right, and step number five.
And step number five is to keep costs low and benefits high. The first four steps focus on the positive elements in the relationship or strengthening what's already going well, implementing positivity. The last step is...
What does that mean, implementing positivity?
So implementing new activities, for example, implementing talking to one another 10 minutes every single day, implementing affective affirmation. So those are all what I would say is changing or strengthening or adding something positive. The last step is focusing on now, after you've added the positive things, focusing or working on the things that aren't going well, like how to manage conflict, like your in-laws, like your jealous feelings. And it's working on costs so you can keep them low and maintain the positivity in that relationship.
Well, you know, Terry, this all sounds fine if people are of completely stable mind. But what happens if somebody gets very depressed? And they're very depressed and they're in the relationship and they just can't find that positivity and they can't motivate themselves. I mean, basically, I think what you're saying is two people of sound mind who don't have any psychological mishaps, you know, like characterological disorders or stuff like that, which is, you know, they do fine. They do fine. But what do you do when somebody's really, you know, just before medication or something, you know, and when somebody's kind of lost it, or sometimes their hormones are out of whack, or sometimes the tension is so great, or sometimes their minds just slip and they get depressed?
Well, I think I would emphasize two points. First, I do make a caveat at the beginning of the book to say that this book is really written and designed for husbands and wives who love each other but feel their marriages or relationships could be better. So it's really strategies, time-tested, scientific findings for couples who define their marriages as okay, decent, or even good. But for those people who are experiencing serious problems, deep-rooted issues, substance abuse, mental illness, this book does not provide enough support. And so my second point would be, Armand, is that for those couples who are experiencing those mental health issues, those serious, deep-rooted issues, I encourage them to find assistance from a therapist, from a counselor, or from a mental health professional. That this book and reading this book will not be enough.
No, but, you know, thank you for saying that, because I agree. You know, all of this is a very good idea if you're a pretty stable character. But when you're shaken up, it's very hard to do. But however... holding these guidelines out there, I think, work well. Holding these five simple steps as being like, okay, that's what I'm shooting for. I'm shooting for a basic positivity. I'm shooting for introducing excitement into my relationship. I'm shooting for a better level of communication. I'm shooting for committed time between us to be able to have some time so that we can just enjoy and not just talk about the problems. Having these as guidelines, I think, help no matter what your state of mind is.
True, and I think those are important goals. I also think it's important, Armand, that, you know, most self-help books out there, most therapists, including myself, I think tend to focus on let's get rid of the problems, let's get rid of the negativity. But what I heard from these couples that were happy over time is that instead of just focusing on the problems, the negativity, the things that aren't going well, I also changed my approach. I switched my cognitive mindset to looking at what's already going well, and that strengthening what's already going well then motivates me to keep going in that same direction toward that goal, as you just mentioned. And it's the positive energy that makes us feel good and that can rub off then on our partner or our spouse who might not be at that same point or that same emotional point in the relationship.
Fascinating, fascinating, because I think that that's, I think that's a very curious, interesting approach, because I find that people very often want to just discuss the problem itself.
I just want to add, Terry, to your comment about how you switched your mindset. I often tell people there's a very big factor that really works for relationships, and that is if you have a growth mindset and you're curious, if you can be open to new ideas and changing your behavior, the feelings will catch up and you will definitely be able to make headway. But if you're stuck and you're fearful and you're fixed with your ideas, that's very difficult for people to really stay in a relationship if you have that type of dynamic going on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Stephanie Dombra, thank you. Terry Orbuch, O-R-B-U-C-H, Dr. Terry Orbuch, 5 Simple Steps to Take Your Marriage from Good to Great. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Terry.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We'll be back with you soon, my friends. If you want to hear this program, you can go to thepositivemind.com or send me an email.